Welcome to the Casey Kowar Show, a celebration of words. I'm honored to have as my guest today Scott Turow. We'll be discussing Mr. Turow's new book, Innocent, recently published by Grand Central Publishing, a division of Hachette, and it's the sequel to Presumed Innocent. So first of all, Scott, thank you so much for appearing on the show today.
Thank you, Casey. I appreciate your interest in having me there.
Scott, just to go back in time a little bit to set the stage for the listeners that have followed your career, I think there's kind of, at least I was guilty of this at first, thinking that you published 1L in 1977, Presumed Innocent in 1987, and that your career as a writer, that was kind of the launch to it. But the fact of the matter is you studied writing at Stanford and taught for 3 years from 72 to 75, so you had quite a background in creative writing before you ever wrote 1L.
Yes, and quite a few unpublished novels to my credit as well. So, you know, I always joked when Presumed Innocent came out in 1987 that I was an instant success in 20 years.
Yeah. And I recently interviewed Carol Sklenica, the biographer of Raymond Carver, and you're mentioned several times in the biography. And I was wondering, what was it about Carver? She mentions that you sat in on some of his workshops. What was it about Carver's work that so impressed you?
Well, you know, your question is ironic because I was in Pittsburgh yesterday for a reunion of a number of the writers who had been in the writing program from 70 to 75. These were in particular the ones who came in 71. And we were gathered at the house of Chuck Kinder, who was one of Ray Carver's best friends. You know, Raymond in those years was still drinking really hard. Mm-hmm. And he and Chuck and Bill Kittredge I used to call them the K-Boys because, and they looked like, all three of them looked like truckers. And they would, they would march around, together. You'd see them coming across the quad, and if you didn't know who it was, you'd fear for your life. But the three of them were older than, those of us who'd come to Stanford fresh from our undergraduate years. But most importantly, they had a really profound understanding of narrative and fiction. And a phrase that both Ray and Chuck especially liked to talk about, which was the silences, meaning what goes unsaid in a story or a novel. And there was a lot to learn from all of those guys, certainly from Ray. And, he wouldn't talk about writing except in the workshop.
Mm-hmm.
So, I did like listening to Ray when he chose to speak, and he spoke pretty judiciously. He was not a blabbermouth or a domineering type in the workshop. So.
Well, thank you for answering that. And anyone that's never read William Kittredge, I highly recommend him. He's a wonderful writer.
Right, he's a terrific writer.
Yeah. So Scott, 1L comes along in 1977. You wrote that. And I've had the pleasure of meeting your agent, Gail Hockman, at the University of the South at the Suwanee Writers Conference several times.
Right.
And I remember her telling the story of an agent's job of going home and reading the manuscripts that are submitted. And I remember her saying that when she read Presumed Innocent, I'm paraphrasing, but she said something like that she called you and said your life is about to change, something like that.
Yeah, well, the tricks of history, of course, are that recollections are so different. I think Gail thought that because her actions certainly bespoke that kind of conviction. Here was an unpublished novelist, and she sent out that manuscript for multiple submissions, expecting publishers to bid against each other. So I think she felt it was lightning in a bottle, but what she expressed to me was caution.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I actually said to her at one point, because she did seem pretty confident about selling it,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, I asked her, well, what do you think I can get for this? And, you know, and she said, well, you know, you're the author of one book that was, you know, pretty successful, so we can't sell you out too cheaply. And she said, you know, but I think you might be able to get $25,000 for this. So so her memory and mine, to say the least, are different.
Thank heavens you didn't take that contract, right?
So, right. Well, I, you know, she was doing what, you know, a good agent should do, which is not building the client up with expectations
right.
that events can't meet.
Exactly.
Exactly.
Yeah. Scott, Presumed Innocent, I remember when that book was published, and at dinner parties, people would sit around, and if someone said, are you reading Presumed Innocent, people would put their hands over their ears so that they wouldn't hear the ending.
Mm-hmm.
And really, it's I wouldn't say that you created the legal thriller genre, but certainly advanced it in a serious direction.
Mm-hmm.
And I am so offended when people compare you to other writers in that genre that I won't name any names, that would be impolite, but I consider you a novelist, and the fact that some of your stories take place in a courtroom, and most of them do, is almost secondary to the writing. But as I was reading Innocent, I was fascinated, and I'm wondering, had these characters been talking to you since Presumed Innocent?
Well, you know, some of them, of course, have made actual appearances in the novels over the years, like Tommy Malto. I think this is Tommy's fifth time around in
mm-hmm.
my novels. So I've been keeping close track of Tommy as time has gone on. And others, like Rusty, I actually wrote about twice before in passages that were ultimately cut. And he also does appear finally as a character in Limitations, although that was kind of cheating since I already knew I was going to write this novel next. But, Rusty in particular is somebody who I sort of felt I had a mental obligation to keep track of because, you know, he had been so good to me.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I think that this is really Innocent is a, I think it's a very complex love story on a lot of different levels. I love the way you open with the prologue, and if you would just discuss for a moment about you move time around in particularly the first couple parts of the novel,
mm-hmm.
and as you were doing this, I love the graph that you put above the chapters where you were doing that. And so did you write this sequentially, or were you kind of writing it the way it appears in the book?
No, I don't write anything sequentially, so you know, the genesis of Innocent was a post-it note that sat on my desk for months that said a man is sitting on a bed in which the dead body of a woman lies. And I sort of eventually, when I realized that man was Rusty Savage, kind of took off from that point, writing first about Rusty's marriage, and then Rusty falls into another relationship. I can recall writing that. Eventually, I began to wonder why the woman was dead, and I certainly knew that woman was Barbara, Rusty's wife from Presumed Innocent. And, and at that point, I suddenly realized I was going to have to probably get into the prosecutor's point of view, and you know, ultimately go back and forth in time. In other words, as I was writing It didn't even dawn on me that these things were, you know, were going to be out of sequence. And but I thought there would be, you know, a way to build tension in the novel by sort of showing what was happening in Rusty's life and the way those events were then interpreted by the prosecutors a year later. And so I got into this, I got into this back and forth in time, which is a little bit complicated by the fact that the events concerning Rusty are related by him in the first person present tense, and the events concerning the prosecutors, which are occurring a year later, are related in the third person past tense. And I knew that that, you know, that that in all fairness, it should be exactly the opposite. And so I was afraid that I was going to confuse readers, and so I put in the timeline. My editor, Deb Futter, who made a number of wonderful suggestions about this book, didn't like the timeline. And ultimately, I sort of took a little poll with my editor in the UK, Maria Raitt, with whom I've worked for a number of years, and Gail, and several other people, and we you know, the timeline won, and Deb, you know, reluctantly bowed to it, but she still thinks she was right, by the way.
Well, when you no longer need it, it disappears, so.
Right, right.
You know, I found it, as a reader, I found it helpful just to kind of keep my place on, you know, on where you were going.
Yeah, no, I thought it worked, but I do have to say that I think the, you know, the designer at Grand Central did a really nice job of not making it too obtrusive.
Yeah, so I would agree with that.
If you wanted it, and you could read through it if you were secure in where you were in the flow of events.
And you did a wonderful job of you don't have to have read Presumed Innocent to read Innocent, and I think you did a good job, an excellent job, and we don't want to have to put any spoiler alerts on this interview because I would never do that, but I could see the craft you were doing to make sure that those that had not read Presumed Innocent could come to this book and enjoy it and get a full serving. And that had to be a very fine fine line to write to.
Yeah, that was a very fine line, how to relate to the events of Presumed Innocent without you know, either giving away or spoiling that book for what now turns out to be a pretty significant body of readers who've never read Presumed Innocent. And you know, I'm 61 years old now, and you know, it's hard for me, and certainly among my age peers, because of the success of the movie, that there are a lot of people in my age range who are familiar with the story of Presumed Innocent. But if you go back, you know, if you start talking about people who are 20 years younger, that's not always the case. And I've had a lot of people who have read Innocent, which, as you rightly point out, Casey, was meant to be a standalone novel, who have written to me and said, gee, I really like this book. I'm going to go back and read Presumed Innocent now. And I didn't want to ruin Presumed Innocent for those readers, because I think there are reverberations between the two novels, and you know, and they will work no matter what order you read them in. And I spent a lot of time thinking about that and conjuring with it, and trying to be sure that they could be kind of, you know, independent events.
And it looked like there were a couple times where you're like, wow, I don't know if I can do this or not. I mean, you know, it's they were so particularly when you get to the legal issues, some of them were so inextricably tied that it was
right, absolutely. You know, and but, you know, there are, you know, certainly there's a lot of what happened in Presumed Innocent discussed in Innocent. The novel, in its broadest sense, is about why people make the same mistakes. And, you have to know what happened in Presumed Innocent to understand that some of this is repetitive behavior.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't want to give too much away. And of course, there are all kinds of things in a novel that a novelist finds funny. Eventually the DNA results from the specimen in the first trial begin to become an issue in Innocent, and ultimately one of the prosecutors remarks that, well, you know, no judge will ever let this in because we'd have to retry the first case, the case against Rusty 23 years ago. We'd have to retry it here. And, of course, that is both true legally, but also in literary terms. I didn't want to do too much of that.
Mm-hmm.
So I had a great time writing this book.
Yeah.
It was both an intricate puzzle, how to make the two books work together, Presumed Innocent and Innocent, and to make a meaningful whole out of them. It was a significant challenge as a writer, and one that, you know, I now look back on and say, you know, well, that you did okay on that.
Yeah, so. Yeah, I would certainly agree. And I beg of people, don't watch the movie. Please buy the book and read the book, Presumed Innocent, because, it is. I went back and reread it in preparation for this interview, and I caught a lot of things that I would have missed,
mm-hmm.
you know. But Scott, talk if you would a little bit about his son Nat, and it seemed that when you were writing it, some of the reasons. I mean, this is really about a love, not. It's about a father's love for his son, and so you can kind of get away with some of the stuff from Presumed Innocent to Innocent because there's this protection of Nat at any cost.
Mm-hmm.
That I would imagine kind of gave you that freedom in some scenes.
Mm-hmm. It did. Rusty Savage. Is somebody who had a very cruel father whose love he missed. And he therefore comes of age feeling that it's, you know, his first task as a human being to be a good father and the kind of father his father never was. And his devotion to his son drives a lot of his actions, including perpetuating his marriage, and ultimately, much of what goes on in the second half of Innocent. But it all has its roots in his own unhappy experience as a son, and not wanting to inflict that in any way on his own son.
Mm-hmm. One of my the characters I particularly enjoyed in Innocent was I'm in my 50s, okay, so I can relate, but Sandy Stern, the challenges that he faces, and he's such an elegant person, but I love the way you integrate how he uses his style, kind of that Argentinian class, and where Innocent is kind of brought up to date is he can drop some Spanish words occasionally, and the jury,
right,
you know, kind of likes that. So this had a modern feel to it, which I really liked.
Right. Yeah. The effect of time on everybody has of course different consequences, and as you point out, ironically, Stern, who was always felt that he was overcoming a disadvantage. If you go to Burden of Proof, which is the novel about Stern, by having a very slight Hispanic accent, as the you know, as the immigration changes and population changes have come to the U.S., as you point out, Casey, he now exerts, you know, some advantage with some jurors because, you know, he sounds like them and can speak their native language.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there's a lot of that stuff in the novel and, you know, the way people and, you know, circumstances change over time.
And the another character that I particularly enjoyed, Scott, was Judge Yee. I got the biggest kick out of him, and I thought he added a little comic relief at times, but also a kind of a sensibility to the trial and kind of an empathy that I just found very intriguing.
Yeah, I appreciate that, and I was very scared of Judge Yee. Judge Yee, for the folks out there, is a native Chinese speaker and still speaks heavily accented English and has succeeded in the trial bar notwithstanding that and is a very good judge. But I was afraid that, you know, because he's portrayed as not a nowhere near as fluent a speaker as he is a writer, that, you know, people would think he was some kind of, you know, racial stereotype. And, you know, I asked a lot of people to read the section B just to be sure that you know, I wasn't doing them wrong. And, you know, Judge Yee has gone down happily with all readers. So that turned out to be a good choice.
Yeah, yeah. And I really like to Scott that there's the writing is just so so elegant, some of the scenes, and the I really like you there's kind of an acceptance that Rusty Savage comes to, I think, that most of us come to in our 50s and our 60s, and you just realize that life isn't maybe going to turn out the way you thought it was. But there's also that conviction on all parties that the guilty must be punished in some fashion, and that's really what keeps society at peace is the threat that there's retribution for wrongdoings. And if Rusty just would have, you know, skated or something like that, it would have really wouldn't have been true to his character or Judge Yee's or Tommy Molto's or any of the different characters that are in the book.
Right. Well, you know, there's, of course, a very complex morality at work in both innocent and presumed innocent, and this is something that innocent really borrows from the predecessor, you know, and it's sort of the contrast between the right and wrong within the walls of the family and, you know, the right and wrong that the law declares. And, you know, Rusty, who is, if nothing else, a pretty moralistic individual, which does, you know, his sense of harsh judgment doesn't necessarily equate with his own behavior, but it is part of his character. And, you know, it's, so you get layers of what is true and what is, you know, what is right and wrong. And in Innocent, you have multiple points of view. And so nobody really knows the complete truth. But, you know, they each have a vision of what's right and what's fair.
Mm-hmm.
And that, of course, is contrasted with the one that, you know, we all have to adhere to as a society.
Right, right. And then, Scott, I reread the end again this morning before getting ready for the interview, and I love the ending, and are you at peace with Rusty Savage? It seemed to me that, I mean, there were 23 years between presumed innocent and innocent, and when you finished this, did you kind of feel like, okay, this I'm at peace with Rusty right now? Or is that just kind of like an ongoing thing that you never really will have the answer to?
Well, you know, I said for many, many years, Casey, that I was never going to write a sequel to Presumed Innocent. And so the one thing I have learned is not to make vows. And, you know, I don't know if I'm going back to Rusty or to Nat and Anna, you know, Nat being, you know, Rusty's son, who's a young lawyer himself. And, you know, I don't quite know what's going to become of anybody yet, and whether that's going to be a question that will preoccupy me at some point, I don't know either. I'm starting to suspect, just because of my own internal barometer, that I'm going back to somebody and some part of this story, but I don't know yet, and I suspect there'll be at least one book in between.
Good. And I'm not going to give it away, but there's some great humor in there when Nat, I thought it was very interesting that he's alternating between studying the law and being a substitute teacher. And Rusty gives him some career advice where I got to tell you, when he gives him the career advice, I had to put a bookmark in the book and sit down and just laugh long and hard about it, because there's some wisdom from generation to generation here, which is very dry, but I thoroughly enjoyed.
I appreciate it. Rusty is often a person of dry wit, and sometimes the author is too.
Yeah, and I also thought it was actually pretty good advice. Scott, I really appreciate the time you've given us today. If we could, let's get caught up on a couple things before we wrap up. I understand that Pleading Guilty, you have, this is a series that's coming out on Fox. Is that still a go, and how do you feel about that?
Well, it is not still a go.
It's not, okay.
Passed on it, I would say, unexpectedly based on the way the show tested, but they were looking for a younger demographic, and but I had a lot of fun watching this pilot be made. It was in really great hands. John Avnet, the noted film director, and Hart Hansen, who's the man who is the executive producer and showrunner on Bones, and just a brilliant young star named Jason Isaacs, and they were doing really good work. You know, the network decision does not have anything to do with the quality of the, you know, of the pilot that they made.
Gotcha.
And I don't think anybody there ever claimed that it did. But
yeah,
you know, programming decisions are always related to, you know, what advertisers are going to pay for.
Sure, exactly. Anything else in the works that you're excited about, or do you kind of take a after you finish a book like Innocent? I mean, you're so busy practicing law and doing all the other things you do. Any other projects you're excited about you'd like to share with people, or are you just
I've had a lot of fun in the last 6 months working with the folks at Second City on a interactive mystery comedy that's actually about to be have its first performance on the Holiday Cruise Line. So, and that's just going to be a little run-through for, you know, further work in the future. That's been a gas, though. It's called Presumed Murdered. And, you know, and to watch those, the almost superhuman comic talents of the people who work at Second City, it's been kind of mind blowing.
That sounds great.
I've enjoyed that a lot. But you know, my greatest pleasure in life is writing novel, for professional pleasure anyway, and you know, I will be getting back to it, but I'm going to give myself a little break in the next couple of months. And,
was the Blackhawks win a big thing for you?
Well, any world championship or, you know, league championship in Chicago is always a welcome event. I was a big Hawks fan as a kid, and you know, my interest in the Blackhawks had waned a little bit, but you know, I never stopped following them, and so I was very happy. And yes, you know, the TV was certainly on in my house when they won the cup.
Good, good. Scott, I'd like to throw out one book. One of your, probably, it might be the favorite book you've written, was The Laws of Our Fathers. Mm-hmm. And I'd just like to put a plug in for the new generation, which is discovering your work. That was a novel that when I read it, I was deeply moved by it, and I still think it's a very fine novel. So I'd just like to put a plug in for that, that the people that listen to the show and are maybe discovering your work at a new level. That was, I just thought, just a wonderful novel.
Well, I appreciate it, and you know, I've written one book that is dedicated to my children, and it is The Laws of Our Fathers. I'm very, very proud of that book, especially as time marches on. So I appreciate the remark. And
well, Scott, and thank you again for writing Innocent. When I first started reading it, it really kind of took me back in time to 1987 when I first started reading. It was kind of like listening to some old Steve Winwood or Traffic or something. I was like, wow, I remember this stuff, you know. And so it was, I'm just grateful that for all of us that are presumed innocent fans that you wrote Innocent. And so congratulations on the success. And when people are asking me, you know, if there's one book I should read this summer, what is it? I tell them, unhesitatingly, read Innocent by Scott Turow. It's a great book.
Thank you, Casey. I appreciate the plugs, and I had a really deep experience writing this book, and I'm glad I did it. I was frightened of it, but you know, it means a lot to me, and I appreciate comments like yours.
Great. Well, thanks so much, Scott, and we'll get caught up with you again when the next book comes out. And again, it's been an honor and a privilege to speak with you today. And thank you for everything you do for the literary community and the legal community as well.
Thank you. I appreciate it, Casey, and it's great to speak with you.
You too. You've been listening to the Casey Kohar Show, a celebration of words. My guest today has been Scott Turow. We've been discussing Innocent, recently published by Grand Central Publishing, currently available in your bookstores and online. Thanks so much for listening. We'll be back soon.